You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where my bedroom should be on every solo female traveler's bucket list. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you cringe at the use of the word every in that opening, then you have found yourself in the right place. Every. So why don't you tell a friend about it so they can join us on our next trip? And joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I credited every single word in that sentence. So I get?
That's pretty typical.
Where's my prize?
You get to continue to be on this show. And you get prize. A cut of the Patreon money.
Oh, okay. Great. I'll be sending Isaac to college with that.
Why will you be sending Isaac to college at all?
I hope not. We're going to put together a lump of money and then when he's 18, just hand it to him and say, do what you want with it.
Probably
Bookers, blow, college, business, whatever you want.
Probably the more rational choice. And speaking of like rational choices and advice to give people, my opening was, of course, a reference to a Forbes article that I sent to you. And the original headline before they did the headline creep again was why Pakistan should be on every solo female traveler's bucket list. And I texted that to you because I thought that was relevant to you and your wife and your son.
Yeah, I think my wife's response, I didn't show it to her, but it would be something like, F no, who the F wrote this garbage? Something like that. Yeah, I mean, every woman who wants to be subjugated under Islamic totalitarianism, but other than that, sure. It's kind of
also
ridiculous,
joined,
isn't it? Oh, anyway,
it's
we're done
true.
Talking about it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's not much else to say, Daniel. I mean, what else is there to say?
Assalamu alaikum. I don't know. Okay, moving along.
Also joining us from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello. Yeah, it's been a wonderful weekend. Some great football on Saturday. I don't know if you guys watched the Michigan game, but I think the team took a third quarter nap, which is usually what I do, but usually the team doesn't do that. So there were three great quarters of football put on by the Michigan offense, and then one quarter of nothing.
Yeah, almost losing to Illinois is shocking, William.
Well, it's funny you say almost losing, but if you only watch the first, second, and fourth quarter, you'd be like, oh, they stomped them. But then the third quarter, absolutely nothing happened on offense. It was crazy.
Yeah, I watched part of that game. You want to know why I watched part of that game? Because it was on ABC. And because it ran so long, they had it on instead of the beginning of the Clemson game. So thank you for that, University of Michigan. Thank you for taking the nap and slowing down the game in the third quarter. I turned on the game and I was like, what is this? It's Michigan without Tom Brady. Who cares? But you guys, you have a big game next week, don't you, William?
Oh, man. The rest of the season schedule is crazy. It's Penn State, then I believe Michigan State, then someone that doesn't matter, and then Ohio State. So it's going to be downhill from here. If we have the three-quarter offense, I don't think it's going to go well.
Is but that like the three-quarter Nelson?
On the upside, if you think we could win all those games, or if we do win all those games, we'll be in the national championship game. Like, no question. So you got to look at the upside.
Yeah, which is insane to me, and I guess this has become a little mini college edition to Belichick Your Premises, but during the Clemson game, I don't know, Daniel, if you watched, but during the Clemson game, they kept talking about if Clemson goes undefeated, will they even be in the college football playoff? If they lose a game, there's no way they can make it because their schedule and conference is so weak.
Okay, Alabama. Hello. Same thing. I mean, all of football is, college football is kind of like that, except save for a few teams who have, I mean, it's part of the weird conference system of college football is you don't get to have these great strengths of schedule.
Right, but the argument is that the SEC is so good that that's why Alabama, Georgia, LSU, Florida are all so highly ranked.
Who really? Are they? They tend to lose in big spots, so I guess, whatever.
Well, I mean, Georgia lost to South Carolina yesterday, which is people saying, people would then use that to say, look how tough the SEC is. But then Clemson almost loses to North Carolina, and they're saying, oh, that's Clemson being weak, not North Carolina being strong. So you figure that one out.
Yeah, they do the same thing in reverse in the Big Ten, right? You lose to a Northwestern, and it's like, oh, well, you just must not, the conference is weak, so this is just, you're just not a good team. You get off the top 25. But I would argue there's a little bit more parity than people realize in the Big Ten, especially when you compare it to the SEC.
My least favorite thing about the Big Ten is that it's like 11 or 12 now or something. Just change the name.
And does Rutgers count as a full team?
Yes, because they're basically a Patriots feeder system, so you don't talk shit about Rutgers. All right,
but
you want
things
to talk
you
about
can
some...
talk shit about.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to talk shit about a bunch of non-football stuff?
Mm-hmm.
All right, then we'll circle back to the football stuff. For now, though, it's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
Before we get to the news, just take a moment to remind you of patreon.com/themidside. Patreon.com/themidside, where you can go and give us a couple bucks every time we produce one of these things. It helps us keep the lights on, but it does not help us keep meatless meat in our tummies because ew. Vox.com reports that while meatless meat is becoming mainstream, it's also sparking a backlash. The growing pushback against Impossible and Beyond Burgers in fast food chains explained. So, when the Impossible Burger launched quietly in upscale restaurants a few years ago, the coverage was mostly positive, with some reviewers even calling it the future of meat. But now that Impossible products have hit Qdoba, Burger King, and supermarkets, they're starting to get a little bit of a backlash against meatless meat. For instance, the CEO of Whole Foods and the CEO of Chipotle both criticize Beyond and Impossible products, calling them too highly processed. Food writer and former New York Times columnist Mark Bittman, who has long called on Americans to eat less meat, criticized the, quote, new higher-tech vegan meats for not addressing resource use and hyper-processing. His website, Heated, has also given plant-based meat some favorable coverage, but recently wrote nostalgically that, quote, not so long ago, veggie burgers didn't masquerade as something they weren't. Justin, meatless meat, is this the thing that will finally save the planet from the evils of human anthropogenic climate change?
According to this article, no. My favorite thing about this article is it's trying to explain the backlash, and then it says the backlash is basically it's not environmentally friendly enough. It's not in line enough with our agenda. It's ridiculous because the backlash against meatless meat is people want to eat actual meat. That is the backlash against it. This is basically what the leftist backlash against this stuff is. And this article is absolutely insane to me. The fact that this is basically not the word I'm looking for, it's not pious, but it's not what's the word, Daniel, when something's not in line enough with the
it's not with orthodox the enough.
It's right, not. It's not orthodox enough. Go. Basically, it's not the problem with meatless meat. It is not kosher environmentalism.
I just That's checked good, the Impossible Meat webpage. It does say it's kosher and halal.
But it's not anti-man enough, is the issue.
That's right. It's not woke enough. It's not a woke burger.
I mean, I don't understand. Like, did you see the swipe they took at regular meat in this article? Where they were like, it's not as unhealthy as regular meat. And then they had like another aside there another parenthetical where it was like the health of meat, which scientists are still debating. What scientists are still debating whether meat is healthy enough for you?
Meat. The reason why we evolved brains, but we still question if it's healthy enough for humans.
From the less perspective, that was not a good move. So, and they've been trying to go back to the pre-brain days ever since. William.
You're going to ask William
the woke
question
burgers
now?
Aren't good enough. The response has not been crazy enough. But what more do they want? It's in Burger King's, for God's sakes. How much more accepted can it get?
Well, that's another thing that really struck
me. I said William.
Oh, I didn't hear you say that.
I'm ready for Justin's take. Let's hear it.
Okay, well, my take really quickly before you go, William, is when I saw that part, it reminded me of like people who like bands when they're underground and then they go main street and they're like, fuck this band, they sold out. It's like Impossible Meat sold out because it became part of the capitalistic system.
But isn't that what they wanted? Wasn't that the end goal? Wasn't that the point? William?
I was waiting. No, I don't think that's the point. Just like with general environmental concerns, it's not that we want humans to live better. It's that we want humans to die. So there's just too many of us. So we don't want a veggie burger that gives us everything that meat gives us, because that's bad. That's pleasure. We want it, in order for it to be pious, it has to be bad, right? It has to taste a little funny. It has to, be different. Otherwise, like, you don't get the, that piety from giving up something that's really good. I also wonder, I'm very confused by this whole processing thing. Like, as someone who grew up in a rural community next to a pig farm, there's a lot of processes that happen before that pig gets turned into a pork chop. So exactly which amount of processing makes it bad, and also what processes are bad? Does anyone understand?
Well, William, I'm assuming this is the answer you're driving towards and you want somebody to say this, but isn't this all just more smuggling in of anti-human rhetoric? Because isn't everything in life a process? So when you say it's bad that something is processed, that means it's bad that we created anything at all and put in any effort at all. Isn't that the only root way to read that?
I don't know, Justin, because if some woke person actually hand-picked the soybeans, I think they would be okay with it versus a combine coming through and picking the soybeans.
So
there's something else going
process?
On there.
So just, right, to sort of bridge what you're both saying, the people in my life who are obsessed with processing use the term whole foods plant-based diet, essentially meaning that the processes you can have are like the processes of picking the apple, the processes of picking the celery or whatever it is, the carrot you're going to eat. But aside from that, any continued alteration of that product down the line makes it worse for you in their argument. So yes, Justin, it is a sort of like if the human mind is applied to this thing, it becomes bad for you.
Yeah.
Which well, is let me ask you this consistent. Then, Daniel. What if I invent a machine to pick the apples for me?
Now we're getting a little bit worse because the machine is going to do something to shake them up or alter them or whatever.
It's going
to
alter their magnetic fields or something, I'm sure.
It doesn't, say a prayer to Buddha every time it picks it and thanks him for the bounty. So it's clearly worse for you. But I think I don't think this is a rational thing, but if there's some quote-unquote legitimacy to the processing argument for Impossible Burger in particular, it's that the number of processes you have to go to manipulate the ingredients to make them somewhat like meat. You are stripping a lot of the actual nutrients out of the things that you're putting together to make it taste like meat just for the sake of the taste. And so,
yeah, certainly the question there's tons of nutrients. Yeah, let's be really clear about that. They're isolating a protein from soybean, and then they're growing a different protein in a bacteria in order to – those are the main two main ingredients. And so you're right. Not getting all the other stuff that you get from meat, right? You get tons of different enzymes and minerals and all sorts of other stuff. From
it's so the one legitimate thing is like, well, how much do you want to alter the ingredients just to mimic the taste of meat? As Ron Swanson might say, why not just have meat? If you're going to go through all that trouble, just have meat.
Well, right. Isn't that ultimately what you're describing, revealing how manipulative the whole impossible meat thing is?
Well, I think maybe what you're going for, Daniel, is this is the same thing we see in other areas that argue from the premise of sustainability or no human impact. Think of all the things that have to happen in order to scale this up. Like if we waved the magic wand and replaced it, you'd have to grow, you know, metric tons of soybeans, right? You'd have to have all these gigantic labs making these bacteria so you can get the other protein you need. All the distribution that happens. You know, meat tends to be a little bit more local than people realize for a lot of things. Certainly a lot of beef goes through Chicago, but you know, there's all this logistical infrastructure that comes with it. Forget totally the energy input required to have all these labs, right? Like when you grow a cow, it's not exactly laboratory conditions out there. They tend to be pretty robust. So it's an interesting conundrum, right? Because they're arguing that this is better for the environment and kinder, quote unquote, kinder to animals. Of course, it depends which animals you're talking about. Certainly the ones that live in the soybean field have a hard time a few times a year.
Right. I think it's that it's better for animals, and now the environmentalist movement is coming in because usually the PETA crowd and the environmentalist crowd are allies, but in this case, they're not allies. And everything you're saying is very well taken, William. My point is that the reason they have to go to such lengths is because they're evading the reality of what they're telling these, what they really want to tell these people. And what they really want to tell these people is everything you've outlined so far, that, you know, humans are bad and we don't really want you to be alive. So they have to trick them into eating things that really aren't good for them and trick them into being environmentalists. But the people who really understand environmentalism are right to point out that that's not really environmentalism, because they can't. Real environmentalism is not marketable. No one will actually do it.
Yep. And it should never go without saying, when we talk about environmentalism, that we need to be really clear about whose environment we're actually talking about here. And for the human environment, a tasty hamburger is ultimately going to be much better for you in basically every single measurable way than one of these impossible burgers. And I mean from an industrial standpoint, I mean from a health standpoint, a monetary standpoint, because the markets have decided this, and this other side is more of a ideological ram it down your throat kind of nonsense. So,
yeah, right before we leave the impossible burger, has anyone actually tried it?
Refuse to.
I refuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so.
You think I'm going to try an impossible burger? Me?
Someone might accidentally give you one. No, the only reason I ask is it's they changed the formula back in April, so I couldn't test it before because I had wheat in it, which aggravates my health issues. So, but now it's supposedly wheat free, and the fat is coming from coconut. So I could actually taste it now. So maybe I'll post in Discord. I'll run to Burger King and see if they have an impossible burger.
I have a only somewhat amusing anecdote about the impossible burger, though. So I found myself in the drive-thru of a Burger King mistake number one. Did I tell this story on the air? I don't remember. Anyway, no podcast memory. But anyway, so it was taking forever. There was just one car in front of me. It was taking forever. And finally, they hand this woman in the car in front of me, an older woman, one single burger, not even in a bag, just one wrapped burger. And it was, in fact, I could tell by the wrapping, the Impossible Burger, because they wrap it in an obnoxious green whatever. The woman continues to sit in the drive-thru, unwraps the Impossible Burger, takes one bite, and hands it back to the woman and goes, "Oh, no, 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 no." And then she made them get her something else. So that's my one anecdote about the Impossible Burger.
So she was just trying it, it sounds like?
I guess.
That's
who
weird.
Tries things in the drive-thru?
That's what I was going to say. Like, can I do that now? Can I have a sample of your French fries, McDonald's?
That's right. Can I have one nugget?
I don't know what I want to eat, McDonald's, so we're going to go through this entire menu until we figure it out. Fuck all these people behind me in line.
Yeah. So, ridiculous. Speaking of effing people over, California, number one in the country for effing people over, is having rolling blackouts to potentially prevent wildfires from downed power lines.
Spoiler alert, Justin. Too late. We already have a wildfire.
Oh.
A wildfire?
So, in an all-too-familiar scenario in Southern California, tens of thousands of people have been evacuated as a fast-moving wildfire threatens the homes of the people in the San Fernando Valley, triggering the shutdown of schools and sections of the freeway. In a separate brush fire in Riverside County on Thursday, flames ravaged dozens of residences in a mobile home park. The explosive events followed an unprecedented move by the Pacific Gas and Electric Company to conduct rolling blackouts affecting up to 2 million people in Northern and Central California in order to avert wildfires, whoops, that could start from power lines knocked down by high winds. With the state plunged into yet another dramatic and deadly wildfire season, experts in land use planning and environment are raising questions about whether California is prepared in the long term and in the face of rapidly changing climate to mitigate destructive wildfires and the loss of properties and lives.
Rapidly changing climate. It got down to 62 last night. That's how rapidly the climate is changing.
All the way down from 72?
Winter.
Yes. Justin, I'm curious, first, if you've been affected by any of this, but also, is this just not unfathomable incompetence from top to bottom?
The fires in the Anaheim area were a couple of years ago, so I haven't been affected this year. The fires closest to me are over in Riverside County. So, or maybe San Bernardino. I don't know. They're one giant.
But how about the power stuff?
Oh, the power stuff? No. The power stuff, I think, is happening more in the areas where there's more wilderness than here, where this is like a denser area. So they're not going to cut off the power in like a denser urbanized area, such as Southern California. The blackouts didn't really affect Orange County as much as they affected other places, because, as I said, Orange County is denser. But that would probably be the final straw. If they started cutting off my power because they were like, "Hey, you're across from Angel Stadium, and we're afraid you might catch on fire, so we're shutting off your power," I might just, like, leave. Because it'd be like...
Galt.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's just absolutely insane if it gets to that point.
So is this incompetence from top to bottom with not only fire management, but insurance stuff, and then also the power company, which is a monopoly? What the hell?
Oh, I mean, hold on. There's hot takes all over Twitter about how PG&E is a bastion of capitalism, and this is what happens when capitalism goes wrong.
Is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, Gavin Newsom even said it. What's the quote in there, Daniel, that Gavin Newsom, threw shade at, to borrow a term, threw shade at the company, blaming it on them?
Gavin Newsom said during a news conference that PG&E's decision only shows how the company has failed to modernize the power grid over the years so that it could turn off electricity in certain areas without resorting to forced widespread usage. I don't know. There's probably another quote in here that you were thinking of, but
no, that's exactly it.
Okay.
It's exactly, that's exactly the quote where it's like, oh, the fault here is PG&E. Oh, it's the company, which isn't even really a truly, you know, private company, right? Because as you said, of the forced monopoly and all of that. But it's the company's fault. It's not the government's fault. And then the other thing they blame it on in this article, they blame it on, we've always thought it's our purpose to move into the wilderness and take over the wilderness. But maybe we should just stop doing that. Where are you going to put all the fucking people then? You're the one who attracts all the people here and then makes it nearly impossible for them to live. So there's a housing shortage of affordable housing. And then it gets built and you're saying that's what's causing the problem. Well, maybe it's all your policies that are creating these issues.
Yeah. And how about passing laws that require insurance companies to cover certain things they wouldn't cover of people living in fire-prone areas? It is government failure at every single step. The wildfire management, the forest management stuff is all the government's responsibility, and they have done nothing but jack it up for decades now, just being horrible at managing the forests and the health of them. William, it's really just shocking that no matter what level you point to, it is a government failure. How can we not communicate this to people? How is it that we have not yet reached people's brains with this information?
It's because everyone is prepped to blame capitalism, right? It's clearly capitalism that's the problem. Every time government regulations cause a secondary issue, it's because we need more regulation, right? That's just the way that these arguments are made. When you don't think on principle and you don't think in terms of property rights, you kind of spiral down the black hole of regulation. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah. Justin, I don't know how much you interact with the fair people of your state. I know you try to avoid them at all costs, but is there this general sentiment there that this is a market failure?
So I don't know how you avoid interacting or at least bumping into people in Southern California. They're everywhere. It's impossible. But I honestly, I have no idea what people think about this. With the people at work, no one's mentioned anything about it being a market failure. I only know my opinion. And my opinion is it's just a failure of humanity allowing itself to actively deal with the problem that faces it. This should not be a problem. This should not be a problem. The only thing that makes this an extra problem in Southern California is how fucking dry it is here, okay? This is a desert, and then there's wilderness that can catch on fire, so it can catch on fire easier because it's drier. But again, you have the entire fucking ocean next to you. It should not be hard for humanity to figure out a way to get water from the ocean to these areas that are going to extra burn. This should be a priority for you. Right. Yes. So, but I honestly, I don't know what people are saying about this because it's not something I care to engage with them about, to be honest. Because if I fucking got it, look, dude, I might get in a fight with someone. And what I mean by that is if I get in a discussion about this with people and somebody was like, oh, well, yeah, it's just, you know, it's just the private companies and they're making it bad for us. I might just fucking punch them in the face.
You're so Bill Burr sometimes. Just so Bill Burr sometimes. Something that's not Bill Burr, Sesame Street, kind of the opposite. But they have a new Muppet, guys. They're adding new Muppets all the time. And, well, this one, this Muppet has a mom who's struggling to overcome addiction. Yes. Her name is Carly. And she's about to help young children affected by addiction to realize they're not alone. So back in May, Sesame Street introduced its newest Muppet, Carly, age six, who had just moved in with a foster family. Now her storyline is going one step further as audience members learn why she had to stay with her, quote, for now family. Carly's mother is dealing with addiction, and her addiction is a sickness that is not Carly's fault. So, quote, What Carly does is she helps bring to life an issue that a lot of people think up as a grown-up issue and don't understand the impact on young children, Sherry Weston, president of Social Impact, said on the Today Show. But don't worry, for those of you watching it with your children and you don't have addiction problems, this character won't be on the main show, at least for now. She's only on a online initiative and on other online videos. So, hoy vey, Justin, is Sesame Street just the new group therapy for America?
Well, I mean, I think all our art is at that point, and that's what this story really... There's a lot in this story, but that's the main thing this story really brings to the forefront of my mind is... Did I grow up in an alternate universe? And what I mean by that is, yeah, my family wasn't perfect, right? And there are issues with my family, especially my extended family. There are issues with alcoholism and things like that. But I grew up in a world where it seemed like, and I'm using the word seemed because I don't want to make it seem like I knew what was going on with everyone's personal nuclear families, but... where there was a nuclear family, and it was usually a mom and a dad and a couple kids, and it was pretty stable, and there weren't drugs involved, there wasn't violence involved, there wasn't all this mental illness involved. But now, if we're listening to things like Sesame Street, and we're listening to all of this woke culture, it seems like they would say right now that what you're hearing me monologue about is... grappling with my white privilege, and it was only because I'm a small segment of the population that controlled the media and controlled the narrative to make people believe that that was real, that that was never real. But it seems insane to me that what's real is we have to have a Muppet for kids with their parents struggling with addiction, because I don't think the numbers are there to line up with that there's that many kids, and that even if those kids do exist, they even have the time and leisure to watch Sesame Street, especially in an online initiative.
On YouTube, I mean,
isn't the number in the article that it's only like 6 million kids or something?
6 million kids under the age of 11 live with a parent who has a substance abuse problem.
Right. You notice how they conveniently do not say what the substance abuse problem is or say what percentage of overall children that is?
Yeah, are they counting smokers in that?
Right. Are they counting vapors in that, William?
Oh, yeah. Ooh, the evil of vaping.
Yeah. The article's fairly disingenuous about this. I think this goes to the question, which I'll throw to William, of basically, what do we see the purpose of children's TV as? Because, and this will be the leading part of the question, if... your child is having legitimate issues struggling with someone who has an addiction, I'm not sure this is neither the job of nor even in the even within the capabilities of a children's show to actually deal with this issue, and is probably better left to a therapist. So, William, what do we see the purpose of children's television being in 2019?
You know, it's funny because Sesame Street has always been about sort of education, right? Being on PBS and all. So what are we educating about in this case, right? And yeah, I'm not sure if it's the appropriate medium. I mean, good on them, I guess, for attempting something. But it does raise some questions to me about... What do the writers and producers of Sesame Street think about America, right? First of all, how many homeless kids are watching Sesame Street on YouTube? Because that was the one from last year. And then, second of all, is the best therapy for children with addicted parents to be watching YouTube, and this video is going to make some sort of difference? It seems a little hubristic. Also, I wonder how they don't get this video demonetized. I mean, It's talking about drugs and it's targeting children.
True. And so, yeah, the homeless Muppet from last year was one thing. Do you remember that there was an HIV positive Muppet?
Oh, yeah. I remember that. They left that out of the article. They mentioned the autistic one, but I didn't remember the HIV positive Muppet.
Hey,
I had to look it up because I couldn't remember. But
while you're looking
that
up, I have a very important question. We've got the new seasons of Crank Anchors. There has been no special ed. I don't think they can possibly do special ed anymore. No. But we can have a HIV positive Muppet, a homeless Muppet, and a drug addicted parent Muppet, but we cannot have special ed. I'd rather have special ed.
That had to have been a network call. You know, Adam Carolla must have pitched special ed and they were like, no, you can't do it. Has he talked about that on any of his shows?
He's basically said that no one asked him. Well, in terms of the reboot, no one asked him about the reboot either. It's not like he was pushing the reboot. Basically, he was told that the reboot was happening.
Oh, he's not involved in it?
Oh, yeah, he's heavily involved, yeah.
He's heavily involved now in doing some of the voices and stuff, but not on the business side.
Right, but he's involved in the creative side, like he writes sketches and stuff like he did originally.
Yes, yeah. But he found out about the reboot at a conference or something when someone announced it, and he was like, oh, great.
Well, what if he had said he didn't want to be involved? They just would have done it without him?
I guess. Yeah, I mean, Comedy Central owns the show, so he doesn't own it.
Yeah.
But to be clear, the HIV positive Muppet was in 2002, but it was just in South Africa. But I remember hearing about this. So Sesame Street's been woker than us for a long time. Sort of, I guess, the opposite of woker than us. Which is kind of weird, is the NBA and all the various companies who have been capitulating to China recently during the escalated Hong Kong protests. So this particular article is an opinion piece by Megan McArdle where she goes off on some of these companies. The title of this article is, quote, "These spineless weaklings have shamed themselves and their country," end quote. So here's how it begins. There aren't enough synonyms for cowardly to capture the craven. Does anyone know what this word is? Pusillanimity? Pusillanimity?
Hold on.
Is that a SAT word that I must have missed?
See if Siri can tell me.
I love when they use words that nobody uses just to sound important. Remember when Bill O'Reilly, or to sound intelligent, remember when Bill O'Reilly used to say pithy? Or keep your comments pithy and leave the bloviating to me. He said that at the end of every show because he thought it made him sound super fucking smart and elite. This is the equivalent of that.
I actually appropriated it as satire in a column called Some Pithy Conjecture, which I found hysterical, and very few people got the joke. But when I was in high school and college, to be clear. So pusillanimity of America's corporate capitalists who have abjectly prostrated themselves, my God, Megan McArdle, put the source down, before Chinese government censors, those spineless weaklings whose expense accounts tower over the atrophied consciences have shamed themselves and their country. This week, the nation saw American sports fans removed from an event held on U.S. soil for daring to suggest that the people of Hong Kong ought to enjoy the same democratic freedoms that Americans do. The incident happened in Philadelphia, where those freedoms were devised at an exhibition game between the NBA's Philadelphia 76ers and a team from the Chinese Basketball Association.
How dare you take issue with something she said? Have you seen the vocabulary she's using?
She's clearly smarter than I am. I'm just saying the freedoms weren't devised there. They were sort of codified there into a constitution, but they weren't devised there. They were devised by philosophers.
But her vocab, Daniel.
I'm just saying she should use some. She could open a history book, other than the thesaurus. So, this followed the National Basketball Association's pathetic begging of forgiveness from Beijing after a tweet by the Houston Rockets general manager supporting Hong Kong's pro-democracy protesters infuriated the Chinese government. China is, of course, a lucrative market for the NBA, and soon the Houston GM came crawling to other companies that have capitulated to China include Apple, and Blizzard and American Airlines, Coach, Delta, Disney, ESPN, Gap, Marriott, Nike, Ray-Ban, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, Justin, how should we start thinking about this? Because clearly, from our point of view, the Hong Kong protesters are in the right and China is in the wrong. And I think also clear from our view, China is, generally speaking, not a great place. But how do we start thinking about how companies should be dealing with China?
We should all just watch this season of South Park and not
be a towel.
Yeah, they
predicted this by like a week. It was like the same week that this episode aired that the NBA got in this mess.
Well, they doubled down on it the following week. So the first week was all about Disney and how Disney basically changes its movies to get the Chinese market. And it wasn't just Disney, actually. It was the kids were trying to make a band. And the record executive were like, bands don't sell anymore. You have to do a biopic. So they started writing a biopic. But everything Stan tried to write, they kept cutting it out because the Chinese government didn't like it. So eventually the Chinese government was just standing over Stan's shoulders as he's writing the script. And then there was also the plot with Disney where Randy got in business with Disney eventually because he was trying to sell weed to the Chinese market. with the Tegrity Farms, and he learned what he had to do in order to appease the Chinese market, which was kill Winnie the Pooh. It's all delightfully South Park in that description. But then the next week, the current episode that just aired this past week, was Randy deciding to no longer go with the Chinese market. Because he had to get back with Tally to make it work again because he had lost his partner. And that was one of the deals Tally made with him. And I don't remember the exact language, but Randy apologized for being a towel. He said, you know, I've been acting like a towel. And Tally made him promise they weren't going to do business with the Chinese market anymore. And I hate to be so extreme and orthodox, but I don't really hate to be so extreme and orthodox. This is what I've talked about before on this show, you know, with the Boy Scouts opening up to Girl Scouts, and they're going to start letting Girl Scouts into their company. All people are into their organization. All people are seeing, Daniel, is the bottom line, and they're not seeing what their mission is anymore. And it's even more fundamental than that. They're not even seeing what their basic principles are anymore in life. It's all just the almighty dollar. And it all comes from the idea that money is not a tool. Money is the end all and be all. They don't see money as a means. They see it as an ends. And they're sacrificing their souls so they can have higher numbers in their bank account. And so I say that these companies shouldn't be doing business with the Chinese government at all if it's that bad. But that creates a major problem. It creates a major problem because they've gotten used to living off of those profits, all that money. We are, in a way, our economy is being propped up by the cheap Chinese goods, right? Everything's made in China. I think I said this years ago on the podcast that there's a reckoning coming with the way we interact with China because the way they're actually artificially propping up the Chinese economy. But it also creates an issue for us as consumers, Daniel. How do I exist without doing business with companies that do business with China? Can I never see a Disney movie again? That's just one example.
Yeah, or own clothes.
Yeah.
Are your Funko Pops out? Where are they made?
Oh, they are not made in China. It says it. I think it's made in Vietnam. Yeah, it says made in Vietnam. Now, I don't know what's the Vietnamese government. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure they're just fine.
It's, again, it's about the line there. But William, so let me play a little bit of a Trump's advocate. I don't know, say devil's advocate, and say let's. Okay, I agree with Justin. The Chinese government is propping us up. It's all this consumer goods. So why not slap a bunch of tariffs on China and create a better trade balance for us and basically punish them until they clean up their act.
Because I don't think that would work. Not at least not in the long term. I mean, I'm no trade policy expert, but my gut here is a more principled approach, really with freedom in mind. And here's what I mean by that. I think the path Justin describes is certainly one you could take, and I would I think that's a valid answer to the question, what should you do about China? But I think there's another direction you can go to, and of course I have to preface this with, this is my personal opinion. What you do is you take a principled approach in your involvement in China. This is something I criticized Google for when they were trying to attempt to enter the Chinese market with search engines and adding censorship tools. See, that would be something I would not do. I would offer the service, but you resist the parts that involve compromising your principles. So if your principle, if you value search results, then you offer the service in a way, you engineer it in a way that you can provide the service, right? And if it's not possible, then you don't do it. Back when, this was many, many years ago before the podcast, China was ripping off Microsoft Windows and just, you know, selling bootleg copies of Windows. You know, Microsoft should have just pulled out of China, right? It's like, you're stealing my shit.
The pull-out method never works.
You don't need it. The same here goes for the NBA. It's, to me, it's really sad when we see all these companies spread these woke politics about LGBT issues, women's rights issues in Western countries, but then say the opposite in other places. In fact, the Blizzard statement was hilarious because in America, they talked about free speech and valuing freedom. And then in China, they talked about protecting Chinese national dignity. Now, to me, that's not the right way, right? You could say, you could be subtle and you can say, hey, we want to provide you our product in China. These are the rules we must follow, and we will continue to try to follow the letter of these rules. And just leave it at that. You don't need to talk about the Chinese national dignity. That's just playing into the propaganda machine. And you're going to make mistakes. These are fine lines to walk. But the more culture and trade China has, the more, I think, the more the likelihood of more Western values being taking hold out there. Now, that not, considering the state of Western culture today, that might not be a good thing, but that is a alternate path.
So, William, I agree with you. I was just already down the line where I'm assuming something like Disney, if they were to go there and say, this is our movie, we want to sell it there, but we're not going to edit it for you, they're just going to say no. And then they're going to completely lose those profits. So I was already down the line with that. Because how would...
I would troll. I would try to troll as much as I could, right? I would put edited for Chinese national dignity and just put that on the screen whenever they told me to take something out.
Would they allow that, though? Because I don't think they would allow that, though.
No, I mean, but I think partially, Justin, what I want to clarify out of your statement is, I think free trade is good. I think free trade helps these countries get better. And you could make, I think, a compelling case that China is, while bad, much, 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 much better than it was when we first opened trade with China, when it was full-blown communist and totalitarian. And now it's only kind of communist and totalitarian. And markets and trade, I think, has helped with that. So I don't think we want to isolate China. That, I think, creates radicalism and would fuel the nationalism. But I do agree that that companies need to start taking way more principled stands, and Blizzard in particular, just such an egregious nonsense statement. And for those unfamiliar, they basically took away prize money from a gamer who won, I don't know what he was playing, but they took away his prize money because he was espousing pro-Hong Kong views. And they later said, that's not why we did it. We did it because he was using foul language, which is, I don't know, if you're in the gaming world, that's kind of laughable to a degree where you might pass out because they would essentially have to ban 99% of their participants.
Right, Daniel. And to me, what you're saying is very well taken, because there's a difference between the NBA and a movie company. And what I mean by that is, look at what you just said with Blizzard. There's a big difference between Blizzard, who doesn't really need to alter their products, as far as I know, and maybe William can fact check me on that, to release in China.
You have to alter it tremendously.
Oh,
there's
they do?
A cultural ministry you have to submit your game to. If it has dead bodies or blood, or, I mean, there was a different game, I can't remember the name of it right now off the top of my head, but there was a game that for like a patch, they supposedly accidentally put the Chinese content patch worldwide, and everyone was like all the artwork was changed, it was stripped down, no blood, the another example, in PUBG, when you die, you wave, you don't fall over and die, and then you disappear.
I kind of like that, though. That's kind of funny.
Yeah. You definitely have to change the content.
Well, okay, so I stand corrected on that, but that actually adds another shade of gray to this, which makes this really interesting. Because what you're saying is Blizzard is releasing one version in China and one version in America, which is much different than these movies, which are releasing one version worldwide, and the U.S. audience is getting the same movie that's been vetted for the Chinese government. That's fucked up. Now, to go to the other extreme, in the case of the NBA, they don't really need to alter their product to broadcast in China. They don't really need to alter their product if they want to have a game in China. Now, they have to fit certain customs. In the same way, when WWE goes to Saudi Arabia, you know, they don't put women's wrestling on. But they're not, you know, changing women's wrestling. They're not doing women's wrestling in the U.S. because you're not allowed to do that in Saudi Arabia. So I think there's differences here where the NBA clearly shouldn't be telling an American on American soil to take their sign away to appease China. But the NBA doesn't have to change their product to do business there, whereas a movie company does, and that's a difference,
about product change. I agree with you there. And then to add to your point, there's questions about how you treat your consumers and your audience members and your participants, which is not really part of the product. So telling people they can't, you know, say free Hong Kong in a game, or telling gamers they can't espouse pro-Hong Kong views in chats and things like that is a
Well, let's
totally
be clear,
because
it wasn't in chat. This is a post-game interview, because we have to also realize whose platform is being used for what. So, you know, if someone grabbed this microphone right here and started spouting pro-China propaganda, I would be mad, not just because it was wrong, right? And I have to go, oh, well, it's their free speech. I would be mad because this is my fucking microphone. So there is a bit of we have to call back to earlier. We have to look at property rights a bit here, right? I think it is legitimate for a company like Blizzard to say, hey, you know, for certain topics, we're not allowing this on our worldwide broadcast. So it's a little more complicated. Now, we can get into the punishment was absurd in this case, right? For Blizzard, there was some American college students in their college series for the same game that basically said, fuck China, and they got no punishment. And in fact, they banned themselves. They said, this is stupid that we didn't get punishment. We're not participating in the tournament anymore. So
they could have just not participated because it was doing business with China. This is a backwards way to protest.
Well, I think they were trying to prove a point that the statements given by Blizzard were not matching their actions. In other words, I think it's okay for ESPN to say, hey, we're not bringing up controversial political topics on SportsCenter, right?
Controversial. I think that's okay. Controversial. Freedom is controversial.
But it's market dependent, right? It's not controversial in the United States, but it's controversial in other places.
Right, and that's my point. That's my point. There's a difference to me between if you have to change your product and when you have to change what your audience is saying. And that's especially where I'm drawing another line there.
And I think no one here, William understands this. I'm just making sure that everyone in the audience is clear for where we're coming from. No one on this show is suggesting that there be legal force use to make someone use their platform in a certain way or not. We're talking about what is right and wrong, not what should be allowed.
And I would go with what you say, William. If I were the NBA, I would say, look, we'll broadcast our games in China. We're going to make a deal with you. And part of that deal is if you want to do a 10-second delay, a 20-second delay, so you can cut out signs like that, fine. That's a Chinese market. If you want to do that, you want to do that. But we're not going to tell our American fans in our American country to not have signs because it upsets you. Because if we're going to respect your views, you're going to respect our views as well. Exactly. And that's how equal trade works. Exactly. But instead, they're going to the stadium and they're saying, hey, you can't use that sign anymore. It's like WWE going around and saying, oh, you can't put an AEW sign in our broadcast, which is fine. And with what you're saying, William, and I agree completely, that's their competitor. If they don't want people to come to their show and pay to go to their show and advertise their competitor, that's fine. But to go in there and say, we're going to censor Americans because it upsets that audience where you have the ability to change the broadcast yourself. Let them do it. Let them do it.
There you go. Let them do it.
That double entendre. When I said let them do it, I meant let the Chinese government edit the broadcast in the way that makes them more comfortable.
I know. Build that great wall.
All right. Well, we're talking about movies and TV shows and entertainment and how to deal with the foreign audience. Why don't we just talk about how we interact with all of those things? It's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events in the air timeline lapse. My made for TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. We just had a thrilling conversation about China and capitalism and the entertainment industry, and these are the kind of topics when there's so much to say about it that I want to hear from you about it. So why don't you join the Discord? We got a bunch of signups for Discord this week. Why don't you join all the new signups and join in the conversation during the week? Look, all the conversation on the social medias is fucking terrible. So if we have this new conversation for ourselves, we don't have to venture out into that wilderness. I've said this before on the show. If I haven't, this is the first time, but I've definitely said this in my life. Things are too global. Let's make things more local. And how about we make them local to our Discord? So go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast, and you can click on the Discord sign up link on any episode. So for this week, I want to do a couple quick reviews, because there's not much to say about either of these things. I saw Gemini Man, and I also saw El Camino, a Breaking Bad story. William and Daniel, did either of you get to watch El Camino yet?
Netflix is super insistent that I watch it, but I've been instead watching the episodes of Disenchantment, which I just finished. So I have my priorities correct, I hope, but I can't wait to hear your take on it.
Okay, so which you want me to do El Camino first and then Gemini Man second?
Yeah, El Camino first.
Yeah, so I can take a quick nap on the Gemini Man part.
Well, that would probably be like you were in the theater. So, look, El Camino. Look, there's nothing wrong with El Camino. I'm not going to sit here and go, oh, man, it's terribly made. Oh, blah, blah, but it's completely unnecessary. Okay? We knew this was unnecessary going in. It was unnecessary watching it. It was basically... this is a spoiler, I guess. But, I mean, any story is how, not what. But I'm going to tell you the what. This is basically of how this Jesse Pinkman gets to Alaska. And that's how it ends. He's in Alaska. I mean, it's sort of like the Dexter series finale, right? Where it's like you go the whole time and then the end of it is Dexter's in Alaska. And you're like, what the fuck? Like, what's going on? But the whole thing is, you know, the logistics of how Jesse gets there. And there's a bunch of flashbacks during it where it's supposed to be, you know, him coming to terms with his past and being able to move to his future. But honestly, the flashbacks were kind of just fan wank. Like, did I need to see another scene with him and Walter White where they're talking about his future? Like, why did I need to see that? I guess, you know, at the end of Breaking Bad, people are like, well, what happened to Jesse? And now we know what happened to Jesse. But what it really calls into question, what it really brings the light to, is the purpose of storytelling and how some characters' journeys only are relevant within that specific constraint, within that specific storyline. With Jesse, it didn't matter what happened to him afterwards, because Jesse as a character served to show how Walter White perverted the world, how he corrupted the world. Whereas Jesse, you know, yeah, he was a low-level, you know, drug dealer, but he could have been redeemed. And I think that's why people latched on to him as a character. He could have been redeemed. But at every chance he tried to sort of push back against the evil that was Walter White, Walter White pushed back against him even more and corrupted him even further and further. So when you get to this movie, which is sort of like, now Walter White's not around, how does Jesse get his second star, his second state, second life? You know, how does he get his clean slate? It doesn't matter as much to me, because I can't get away from the fact, watching the entire movie, of all the fucked up shit he did. So look, I'm not going to tell you not to watch it. I'm not going to tell you it's bad. I'm just going to tell you that unless you're a hardcore Breaking Bad fan, there's really no value to this. As someone who watched it all and you know, admires it for its portrayal of evil, Breaking Bad, and saying, you know, this is a good piece of art, but it's not particularly my cup of tea. Having seen that enclosed narrative, I didn't need to see this because I had seen this enclosed narrative. Now, as for Gemini Man, my number one takeaway from Gemini Man after having watched it was how much fucking Will Smith must hate Keanu Reeves. And what I mean by that is, did you know back in the day, Will Smith turned down The Matrix?
Really?
Yeah, they originally pitched it to him. And he says that's his greatest regret of his career, is never taking The Matrix role, never being Neo. Well, now you look at this movie, Gemini Man. Well, you know what the premise of this movie is?
Someone kills a puppy and then he has to kill a bunch of Russians?
Essentially. I mean, you said it very concretely comedic effects, but he's a hitman hired by the U.S. government, and he's the best there ever was. And he tries to retire. But a conspiracy that fucks with his life pulls him back in, and the conspiracy tries to kill him. And then he has to get back involved with being a hitman again. And the conspiracy in this case is they cloned him, and the clone is the one who's sent after him. So he has to figure out what's going on. So it's essentially a very similar movie to John Wick, just slightly different. And unfortunately, having seen John Wick and how beautifully that's directed and beautifully executed, watching this movie, it just feels empty and hollow. It's not a bad movie. Look, I didn't sit there and watch Gemini Man and be like, oh man, this is a terrible movie. No, I enjoyed it. It was fine. It was fine, but it was like a C+, especially the beginning. The beginning was very much like, oh, here's dialogue, here's conversations, and all of the setup, it wasn't very intricate, interesting setup. Whereas you watch John Wick, and especially the first one, has such phenomenal setup for what's going on. This was just set up in an uninteresting way. And then when you get to the more action-based stuff, it gets better. But again, it's a C+ movie. I don't regret having seen it, but there's just so much better stuff out there that I would say it's not really, unless you're a huge Will Smith fan and you just are a huge sci-fi fan, you need to see everything. I don't really see there's much of a reason to see this movie.
Can I wake up now?
Yeah, and I can probably wake up because clearly I didn't see anything tremendous this week, huh?
Sad weekend for Jeez. You.
Well, everything nowadays, it's very rare that something comes out that's like phenomenal. And it's like, oh, wow, I really loved that. And I don't know if that's just, you know, the industry in general or just the way we're at culturally. I think it's probably the latter, but it's sort of disappointing in that way. And when we're talking about, you know, things that are going to, you know, everything that's coming out and nothing really exciting us, why don't we talk about like what could and could not excite us? As always, I post a trailer takedown preview on Saturday mornings at the latest on the website. So you can go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast and click on trailer takedown preview. And you can watch the trailers. You can watch them before you listen to the episode. You can watch them after you listen to the episode. Or you can alternate, you know, watch a trailer, we talk about it. Watch a trailer, we talk about it.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Midway is about the Battle of the Midway from World War II. It's directed by the guy who did Independence Day and The Day After Tomorrow. And for me, the best part about this trailer was how it looked. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, and I'm really interested in Daniel and William's perspective on this. Most war movies really try to emphasize the tragedy of war by kind of sucking all of the color out of it and make it look very uninteresting and very boring. So even though there's a lot of intensity in the movie itself, they sort of suck the life and the soul out of it and purposefully, and they're playing with this tension. But to me, it makes the movies visually boring, and it makes me not want to watch war movies. Whereas this is the closest I've been to wanting to watch a war movie. This was sort of like Dunkirk, except they heightened the colors a little bit more and they played with the palette a little bit more. And I really liked how that looked visually. I also liked a lot of what they were saying as far as the content about it, about how, you know, we're going to show you this battle and how important it was and how it mattered for American life. So there was a lot I very much liked about this. It's just that I don't really like war movies. And unless somebody really tells me there's a reason to see this, or it does really, really well, or maybe it comes out in a week where there's not much else coming out, it's just, I don't think I'm going to be very motivated to see this simply because of my aversion to this type of movie. So as much as there are all these things I like about it, this is going to be a tackle.
Tackle?
Pretty much. Exactly. Daniel, go ahead.
So it's very stylized. And you know what the coloring actually reminded me of was a black and white movie that was later colorized. That's what it actually reminded me of. And so I thought that was kind of cool. Admittedly, the beginning I thought looked kind of hokey, and I thought this was going to be a Pearl Harbor reboot of sorts where it's going to be laughingly bad. But by the end, I was kind of rooting for the film. So I'm a little torn. I don't typically see war movies, although this movie is an action movie of sorts. So maybe my wife will drag me to it. I'm going to be optimistic this week and give it a tentative hug.
Hug.
William?
So, yeah, guns, airplanes, battleships. You know I'm in. I, too, was struck by the visuals. It almost reminded me of a video game's aesthetic for this setting. Okay? So I'm not saying this looks like a video game, just to be clear. I'm saying, like you were saying, the colorization, the way the shots were happening, the action. It didn't look like we would have much shaky cam. It looked more like a more controlled camera on some of the shots, which makes for a easier to parse visually movie. And I think it'll play well in the Chinese market since the Japanese are the bad guys. So I'm going to hug it.
Hug. Second trailer.
Motherless Brooklyn is a movie written, directed, and written and directed by and starring Edward Norton. In the beginning of this trailer, I was into it. And I was like, oh, there's Bruce Willis. And then something interesting happened where they started talking about, oh, we got to protect the poor people, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized this is just the Joker remixed. And what I mean by it is, here's a guy living in inner New York City who has a weird mental condition and is trying to figure out how to deal with the depravity and the poverty around him. There are things I really like about this. The main thing is the cast. But as far as content, I just don't think the content of the movie is something I'm going to like. Although it is interesting that Bruce Willis is in it, because Bruce Willis doesn't usually pick movies that are like that. So as much as I appreciate the fact that this is written, directed, and starring the same person, I can't bring myself to see this movie. Tackle.
I think Ed Norton could have titled this movie "Because I Didn't Win an Oscar for Primal Fear." No humor, no joke. Okay, fine. I'll take my old references and move on with a tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, that was a really old reference, Daniel. Yeah. That's why no one laughed.
This is, come on, it was your genius. Dad joke transformation is complete.
Oh, it was a brilliant joke. He lost to Cuba Gooding Jr. that year.
Oscar's so white. let's see here. I watched this trailer twice, and I just couldn't get over the hump of thinking that this was going to be interesting. I got the King's Speech vibe, right? Like, here we're showing a broken man being a hero. Maybe this is going to be better than what this trailer says. It looks like it's going to be a boring movie, which is never a good sign. Now, that could just be that they're hiding some sort of twist that and not giving it away in the trailer. So even with that benefit of the doubt, though, I think I'm going to tackle this one.
Tackle? Third trailer.
Jungle Cruise is Disney's live-action adaptation of The Jungle Cruise, and it stars The Rock. Now,
boom.
Exactly. Knowing me, you guys know there's probably nothing else that really needs to be said about this movie. But this is what else I will say. I got a Pirates of the Caribbean vibe from this. And what I mean by that is, at the beginning, when Emily Blunt like gets out of the wherever area she's in, the way she gets out is very much the way Jack Sparrow gets out of situations. So if they approach this movie in the same way, where it's sort of that adventure vibe to it, it's going to be phenomenal. So for me, this is a sorry. I know I'm probably a hypocrite here because it's Disney in the Chinese market and they killed Winnie the Pooh, but This is a hug for me.
Hug.
Daniel?
Of the three movies so far, this is your hug. This piece of crap is your hug. Justin, please. My God, man. I thought
I
you were serious.
I can actually hear his erection through Discord right now.
Jeezy Pete's, Justin. This looks ungodly awful. It does. I will say that if there is a good thing about it, it looks like it has a weird Pirates of the Caribbean aesthetic, which is interesting, but not nearly enough to have me sit through even another trailer for this movie, let alone the full film. Absolutely tackle.
Tackle.
So do you think this will be as bad as The Haunted Mansion starring Eddie Murphy, which I never saw?
Could it be as bad as that? It'll be bad.
William?
I do not share Justin's erection over this movie. It looks like a... if this turns into Pirates of the Caribbean, I'd be super surprised. I understand aesthetically where you guys are seeing that vibe, but I don't know. It just looks like a stupid kids movie along the lines of the many cash grabs by The Rock. So I think I'm going to tackle.
Tackle.
A stupid kids movie starring The Rock. You left that out.
Final trailer.
Onward is Pixar's next movie about tackle. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, Daniel. Don't flip out.
Oh my God.
Don't flip out. Don't flip out. Don't flip out. Don't flip out. Yeah, keep mashing the fuck out of that like button, William, because this is where I redeem myself in the eyes of Daniel. Oh my God, does this movie look gorgeous? I don't know what it is, Daniel, about this animation, but this might be my favorite looking Pixar movie ever. This is, there's just something about this that I'm just like, wow. And then the emotional impact of this story where they're integrating this idea of there's no more magic in the world with that guy's father dying or leaving when he was young or whatever. There's just so much potential in this story and the way it looks. I can't say enough the positive reaction I have to this trailer. I have never been more excited for a Pixar movie than I am for this specific movie. I have extremely high hopes for this movie. So, super hug.
Hug?
Happy now, Daniel?
I'm not unhappy. Much better take than on the last film. I didn't have that strong a reaction to the film, although I did notice how incredible it looks. And I think when you do a story about fantasy and magic, that you have to kick it up a notch. And I think they did. Fascinating world they've built around. Very cool plot. I didn't think all the jokes landed, which I don't think is necessarily a bad sign. It could just be a trailer thing. Bad editor on the trailer. So that was my only critique. But otherwise, this looks like yet another outstanding Pixar movie. Hug.
Did you pick up the did you pick up the Weekend at Bernie's reference in there?
No. What? Really?
Yeah, the way they had the thing, the dad propped up, and then like he had the sunglasses on and his head fell over.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. So why is my Primal Fear reference less timely than the Weekend at Bernie's reference?
Because Weekend at Bernie's is a classic movie franchise. Do not besmirch Weekend at Bernie's. And if you go after Crocodile Dundee next, we're done. This show is canceled.
Wait, we're not. The Chinese aren't going to cancel us anyway?
That's right.
Anyone who finds this, disclaimer, anyone who finds this podcast in the Chinese market, I do not market this to the Chinese market. I do not find a way to put this on the Chinese market. That has nothing to do with me, okay? So if you're listening on the Chinese market, I'm sorry your country is terrible.
William?
Oh, how do I follow that? I don't know what else to say other than we should watch this movie together, Justin. We should go out and do a... do a viewing, much like we used to do when Star Wars, when we had hope for Star Wars. I'm going to hug this.
Hug.
That sounds good to me. You know what also sounds good to me? Let's wrap up this episode in a fan favorite, our one fan who gets really excited about this segment. But I'm going to assume he is representative of other fans. It's time to Belichick our premises.
Go talk to the geniuses that are online.
Recorded during the early slate of week 6 games, because the Patriots played on Thursday night, it's time to Belichick your premises. And since we're recording during those games, just a quick scoreboard check right now. I'm scrolling through the scores here, Daniel, and I don't know if you've looked during the podcast at all, but we talked about last week's games being boring. There's nothing going on in any of these games. So far there's a 7-7 score, a 7-6 score, a 0-0 score, a 10-0, a 0-0, and a 0-7 score, 7-0 score. Holy shit, is that boring. Are you kidding me? And
I take it you're not a huge defensive player guy then.
Okay, none of these are because of defensive teams, okay?
Yeah, that's
Ravens,
true.
Bengals, okay? Maybe the Bengals aren't scoring because of the Ravens defense, but the Bengals are just terrible. And if the Ravens can't score on the Bengals, well, fuck them. Browns, Seahawks, maybe that's defense. Saints, Jaguars, again, the Saints should be able to score on the Jaguars. Texans, Chiefs, neither of them have a defense. Redskins, Dolphins. How do neither of them have? Are they both that bad that they can't score at all? And then the final one is Eagles, Vikings. Well, okay, that's probably a defensive game, so that's probably the best game right now. But yeah. Do you agree with William or do you agree with me that this is all defense?
It's mostly bad play. The Eagles, Vikings is clearly the best game of the morning. The Redskins, Dolphins game is interesting because. What does a game look like between two teams who are now actively trying to lose?
You see them all running backwards into their own end zone.
It's only 10% a joke. I mean, the Dolphins are pretty much telegraphing now that they are tanking for Tua. And the Redskins, after firing Gruden, are basically, this is a rebuilding season for them. So... What does that game look like? Overtime at 0-0.
I hope the Dolphins get Tua because he's going to be terrible in the NFL.
Yeah, tanking for terrible Tua.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's talk about the topic I wanted to bring up for this week's Belichick Your Premises.
Hmm.
It really struck home to me on Thursday because I only think about it when it affects my own team. No. It struck me for a while now, but something happened in the Patriots game that really drove it home. And it's that Brady and Belichick, after the game, both mentioned that due to injuries, they were stuck in one personnel grouping for the entirety of the second half on the Thursday night game against the Giants. And this season, it seems like, and I don't know where the numbers line up, but it seems like there's been a greater number of injuries than ever before. I mean, when you look at Nick Foles was out for the season from the beginning. Ben Roethlisberger is out for the season.
Drew Brees is out for 6 weeks.
Did you just say Cam Newton and Drew Brees?
Yeah, Saquon Barkley, Tyreek Hill.
Any more? Can we name any more players?
Well, but isn't this how we find new players, new breakout players? I mean, we've got a great generation of active players right now, some of them playing much later in their career than we have seen in the past. Injuries are going to be more likely, but at the same time, this is, you know, it seems interesting that they were, like you said, they were stuck in the same personnel group, but how do you ever see any breakout players if we're just seeing the same players over and over?
Well, there's certainly the element of, yeah, injury gives other people a chance. And I'm certainly not saying that injuries are bad for that reason. Yeah, that's great that it gives other people a chance. Traditionally, the way you do is you just get older and you lose a step, and then a younger player comes in who has more upside, and so you go with that player over other players. But when we're talking about players like Nick Foles and Tyreek Hill and Saquon Barkley, they're not that old. I mean, Nick Foles is the oldest out of all of them, and he's 30. They're not that old. I mean, as a quarterback, Nick Foles would have, what, 8 to 10 years left?
20, if he's...
Traditionally? If he's Tom Brady, yeah, he'd play forever. But the question I have is the injury rate higher? Is the NFL too dangerous now? Does something need to be done to make it safer? And I don't mean this concussion stuff that's going on. I mean, that's obviously they're handling that. But is there something about the way the league is now that's making it more unsafe for these players? Is it too brutal?
Well, you could make an argument that when you add more safety protocols, when you add less, when you take less responsibility away from the players to keep themselves safe and put it more on the equipment, that you might actually end up with more injuries. I think that's a hypothesis more than it is a statement of fact. But what's the Dr. House thing that I think we brought up in the show before? If you really wanted safe driving, you'd just put a machete in the steering wheel pointing at the driver's face. Then no one would ever go over 2 miles per hour. But you'd have safe driving. So, you know, people have joked before that, like, well, just take away the helmets and you'll have fewer concussions. Because people won't run at each other and people won't lead with their head and it'll be a much slower game, but you'll have way fewer concussions. So the question is there something that we're doing on the safety side that is actually incentivizing more harm? That's at least one way to think about it.
That's a really interesting way to think about it, because when you say that, that sort of rings true to me, where the way the rules are set up is it's supposed to be the rules that are protecting you and you're not protecting yourself or the other player. Whereas in contrast, we always, you know, go back to Brady and Belichick in this. Brady has put in high emphasis on protecting himself, and that's why he's been able to avoid injury so well. So is it just the rules that are making it so players are being more reckless because they're saying the rules will protect them and others, or is there another reason? William, your point about the aging of these players making them more likely to get injured is very well taken with that as well. But is there something with the younger players where they're less likely to protect themselves because of something beyond the rules?
Well, yeah, I think there's an incentive when you're younger to stand out, and that means taking more risk, and maybe that also includes risk to folks' body.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you only have a limited amount of time, and it's a very meritocratic system, so if you stand out, you're more likely to make more money and play more, and thus, to stand out, you have to do things like push yourself beyond what you might be comfortable with. So now the question is, are there things that the NFL is doing that make that worse, or is that inherent to any high performance athletic endeavor?
Right. Well, and then the other argument comes in because of that, Daniel, is, you know, is this just naturally what happens when we develop so much, when there's so much advancement? I mean, you look at the athletes today versus the athletes back in the day, there's not even a comparison. They're so much bigger, stronger, and faster. Isn't that naturally what's going to happen?
Yeah. So I guess the other question is, since we are Belichicking our premises, is the NFL unsafe in comparison to what? So, just for really broad context, I'm not saying this is a great argument, but for really broad context, when you look up like the 25 most dangerous jobs, obviously NFL doesn't make the top 25. But you look at things like that are up there and then compare the risk of these jobs to the reward, because that's another thing you have to consider when you're talking about injuries in the NFL, is what is the reward compared to the risk you're taking. So the number one most dangerous job, at least in America, is logging.
Women and minorities, hardest hit.
Turns out, not so much. But 135, basically 136 fatalities per every 100,000 workers. Fatalities, Justin, per 100,000 workers. And last year, more than 900 non-fatal injuries. Most common accident, struck by object. So having a log fall on you.
I'm shocked that would happen.
Do you know what the median annual wage of a logger is? Do you want to guess?
I shudder. Yeah, I was going to say.
It was 45. It's 37.9. 37.9.
Why would you be a logger and not just work at Walmart?
My God, man. Fishers come after that. Flight engineers is apparently a pretty fatal job. Roofers, which I would have guessed would have been a dangerous job. structural engineers, etc., going all the way down to the 25 most dangerous job is heating and air conditioning installer.
Yeah, there's a lot of climbing around on that, so that makes sense.
8.5 deaths per 100,000, median annual wage, $45,000. So, obviously, there's risk to doing a lot of things. Certainly, when you're playing professional sport at that level, there is risk to that. But they're also making, what's the league minimum, a couple $100,000?
Main roster, it's $400,000, I thought, was the minimum.
Yeah, I don't know. But, yeah, so even to just sit on the bench, you're making that money. And then if you're a big star, you're making millions of dollars, but you are taking a risk. And I think what's most important about this conversation is that the NFL does a better job, and better just meaning they could always do better, educating players, one, about the risk, and two, about mitigating risk, and three, about maximizing their reward, saving money, investing, doing things to protect their earnings, because it's going to be such a short period of time that they are earning.
100%. Everything you're saying is very well taken, and your point's very well taken. I don't want to make it seem like this is a moral discussion, though. I'm not asking if the NFL is immoral because of the rate of injury and the risk of injury. What I'm really asking about is, for us, the fans, the product that's on the field. Because essentially Thursday night, we had to watch a Patriots team that was stuck in one personnel grouping the entire second half. Now, ironically, because for some reason this is how the Patriots work, they did better in the second half with the one personnel grouping where they had two rookie wide receivers in there. One was drafted, one was undrafted. So they did better in the second half when that was the case. They even ran the ball better in the second half when that was the case. So maybe I shouldn't be complaining. But my point is, doesn't at a certain point, it affects the quality of the product because the best players aren't on the field? Now, this goes to Williams' point, right? Because Gardner Minshew and his mustache would have never gotten a chance if Nick Foles never broke his collarbone.
Yeah, and Jacoby Myers wouldn't have had a chance if Josh Gordon hadn't injured his knee, and we wouldn't have gotten to see that Jacoby Myers is an excellent receiver.
Well, some of us watched the preseason and already knew that, Daniel.
Well, I did too, but I'm talking about the general audience who's not as stupidly into it as we are. So it cuts both ways, and need I say the words, Justin? Tom Brady? Wasn't he the ultimate result of injury that's part of the game?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think you just Belichicked our premises with that statement right there. for the uninitiated who don't know about the myth of Tom Brady, Drew Bledsoe took a hit in the second game of Tom Brady's second season, and we've had Tom Brady ever since. So Drew Bledsoe's hit put him in the hospital. He had to have surgery, right?
Yeah.
He had to have surgery. It was really bad. It was life endangering. So maybe things haven't changed at all, and it's just perception because of the media, and maybe the Patriots are just having a year with injuries. I did hear someone say that it's in odd years. The Patriots have injury troubles, so I don't know if that's like a deal Bill Belichick made with the devil to win so much, where the devil is like, every other year we're going to make it really hard on you just to see what you do.
Yeah, I mean, there are no Chargers who can barely put out a 53-man roster at this point.
They just know that they're okay because if they run out of players, they'll just put Phillip Rivers' kids on the field.
Is it true? I didn't go back and fact check this, that Phillip Rivers once played an AFC championship game with a torn ACL, like a known torn ACL.
I mean, probably Logan Mankins did that back in the day for the Patriots. And you could see Phillip Rivers doing that.
That's ridiculous.
Let me see. Did Rivers play on torn ACL?
Good pod. Live Googling.
Live Googling the pod.
Live Googling.
Remember that game when Phillip Rivers played on a torn ACL? Yeah, it was the 2007 AFC Championship game against the Patriots.
What?
So, good on him. So, for some reason, this became Belichick Your Premises, the Phillip Rivers edition, but, I kind of feel like I have to take back a lot of the negative shit I said about him. No, I don't. He's still a moron. He still makes bad decisions. All right. Is there anything else we want to say about this this topic, this episode of Belichick Your Premises? I'd just like to say really quickly that I think there's an element of emotionalism where people wanting to get big hits in and everything. I don't know how you get rid of that in football, which is a very animalistic, primal sport, and sports in general are very physical and concrete. But I do think there is more emotionalism in it now than there used to be, and I think that contributes to the wanting to hit people. But I don't know how much. Do either of you have anything else you want to say about the NFL while we sum up here?
No, but I do need to make amends for not mentioning the Saints in our last episode of Belichick Your Premises as a threat out of the NFC. But they had not beat the Cowboys at that point, so it was not a foregone conclusion that they were going to be epically great. Because if they had lost there, I'm not sure they'd be in the conversation. But they did win. They won pretty handily. And they're going to get Drew Brees back pretty soon. And as I've said for years, looking forward to that Brees-Brady Super Bowl.
Yeah, I would love a Brees-Brady Super Bowl. I do think the Saints are a good team, but they're only up 3 on the Jaguars right now. So before you Saints fans get all excited, okay.
But it's with Teddy, so we'll see. William, anything to close there?
Go Patriots.
Yeah.
Acceptable. Hit that music.
My face, your face, instant face. Go talk to whoever you want that does that stuff.
All right, let's sum up this episode. Let's put a bow on it. What did we learn this trip? Who goes first? William? William, go ahead.
I learned that the midside is not marketing in China because we will not modify our content for censors.
Daniel?
I learned that even for this show, even for pod ratings, I would not eat an Impossible Burger. Justin, what did you learn?
I just realized that I forgot to change my fantasy lineup. So I'm probably pretty fucked this week. Although, did you see last week? This probably should have been Belichick Your Premises. Did you see that I scored like 179 points and still lost last week?
That's the most Justin thing to happen ever.
I fucking hate fantasy football so much.
Well, we hope you learned something this week, even if you're in our fantasy football league and beat Justin, that you learned that Justin has horrible fantasy luck. So good on you. But tell us what you learned or what you're disappointed with or what you were delighted by on all the social medias at The Midside. Or you can go to themidside.com/podcast, leave some comments on pages there if you're so inclined, and listen to all the past episodes going back to the way back, years that I've long forgotten. But you can also check out things like the Snyder series and Nolan Notes there and just relive a good time with us. There's also themidside.com/store where you can get your Midside merch. You can go to Apple Podcasts or Google Play, give us a 5-star rating, helps us move up the rankings. We much appreciate that. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. We appreciate our libertarian listeners. And patreon.com/themidside where you can go and give us a couple dollars when we produce one of these shows. It's real simple. It doesn't matter what amount of money. It can be anything. We sincerely appreciate it, and it does help us with pay for things like web hosting and storage and microphones and whatnot. Patreon.com/themidside. But if you can't do any of that, no problem. Here's one thing we hope you can do, which is tell a friend about the show. Tell a friend about the show. It's how the show grows. It's how we take over the world. It's how we make more Midsiders. So until next time, we love you.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day, except in China.
was shocking to me recently, hanging out with a bunch of people from other countries, like 11 other countries, just how much more they despise China than Americans do. We're all into this Russia thing. No, no, no. The rest of the world, all looking at China as the big threat. China, big threat.
I mean, I think we just don't say that because we're sucking on China's warm teat right now, as South Park said.
And it is very warm.